Okay, so we will continue with our... I'm very happy to introduce one of our hosts, Thomas Elbert, who is professor of the Clinical and Neuropsychology Division at the University of Konstanz. And his major research focus, as Maggie told before, are trauma and appetitive aggression. And I'm super excited to hear more about appetitive aggression, which Thomas will focus on as an adaptation or maladaptive process in terms of epigenetics.
Well, good morning, everybody. First of all, I would like to thank Daniela, Maggie, and Amber for putting together this interesting workshop. And I'm not sure whether I'll be able to adapt to molecular biology, but I try to do my best. The question, of course, is, can you get any interesting information from human data? Typically, we can collect saliva or blood. We certainly cannot get like tissue in the hippocampus or other regions of the brain of interest. And the first example, I think you know this, is these two creatures are exactly the same. And we can construct from saliva and blood samples what has been called epigenetic clock. If we combine a number of methylation sites and we calculate this DNA clock, the age based on the methylation, we find a very nice correlation across the years. I think that's amazing. Give me a piece of saliva and I can tell you how old you are. There's some information there that has face validity in a way. So, of course, the next question is, what can we do with this information from the perspective of a psychologist and of social sciences in general? As Sanjay just already mentioned, we have basically the static epigenome, which differentiates the cells and makes us look a little bit different than other monkeys. And we have, of course, the more flexible part, which means, or which we believe has been evolved or developed because it can be adaptive to the environment. And one of the strongest changes that we can bring about in humans is, of course, we expose them to severe stresses, to chronic stress and traumatic stress. And we have the major defense system, that's the HPA axis, as you know, and it is built of different elements. One important way to provide feedback and regulate this axis are the glucocorticoid receptors. Most cells actually do have glucocorticoid receptors, not just those who regulate the HPA system. And we can, of course, look at the methylation, the promoter region of the glucocorticoid receptor. And another gene, protein I would like to talk about is FKBP51, which is a co-chaperone of the glucocorticoid receptor, which means it determines the folding and trafficking of the protein, and thus in this way also manipulates or determines the function of the HPA axis. If we expose people to extreme stresses, we change this regulatory system, we change our major defensive system. And we can show that, for instance, if we look at the expression of glucocorticoid receptors in different groups, people who have not experienced life-threatening conditions or very few ones, those who have been exposed to serious traumatic stresses, this can be earthquakes, natural disasters, accidents, but also war and torture and forms of family violence. And if, I think most of you also know, if you expose people to a number of traumatic stressors, they develop a disorder. And this is called post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a memory disorder, memory of these traumatic stressors, and you change the HPA axis as a consequence, depending on how many traumatic stressors a person has experienced. Now, is that adaptive or is that maladaptive? I would like to show you one example. That's the water flea. And if you expose the mother to a predator-rich environment, I think it's enough that the smell of predators, these are fish which eat these water flea. If you expose the mother to these predator-rich environments, these little creatures grow helmets and spikes. And of course, the question is, what if you expose a human mother to stress, violence, and poverty? Of course, we do not grow helmets and spikes as humans, but maybe we change other ways of responding, of defense, of our, maybe we change our major defense system. And what's interesting in this water flea, they not only change their physical appearance, they also change their behavior. So they stay during the day in the bottom and only go up in the night to the surface of the water where there is the nutrition. So it's adaptive if there are predators around, but it's maladaptive, of course, if there are no predators around. And the question I ultimately want to ask today, can it be adaptive under certain circumstances if you expose a mother to stressful conditions for certain stressful environments the child will encounter later on? If we look in humans, if there is a threatening situation, we usually try to escape it. We flee, it's a flight, or the fight response is an alarm response. You all have experienced that alarm response. That's one way how we respond. But there is a second way, which we should not forget. If the predator is already very close to you and you cannot escape, you better play dead. You dissociate or you even faint. This is Maggie Schauer's defense way of picturing the defense cascade here, that you have a flaccid immobility, in this case with a parasympathetic dominance. We all know that we release adrenaline and we release cortisol in the fight and flight response, but here we see a different responding. And sometimes people can induce this part of dissociation by themselves. And they do it by actually using stimuli that are biologically prepared to activate this shutdown, as Maggie has termed it. It's a self-injury, and it relieves through the vasovagal collapse these people from their aversive experiences and memories. So we have these two ways of responding, and this is related to externalizing behavior. You fight, you may be even antisocial, you may be aggressive, and this is more internalizing problems where you are rather depressive, submissive, and even up to a point where you do not move any longer. Okay. Now we look at mothers who have been exposed to various forms of stresses during the pregnancy. In particularly, we can look at intimate partner violence. Unfortunately, that's a worldwide endemic problem. About 20 to 30% of women experience severe intimate partner violence during their pregnancy. It will activate their HPA axis, their stress axis. Cortisol will be released, and as we know, there's a cascade of biochemical changes that affects the development of the child while being still in the womb. And the first thing is, of course, if we look at the promoter region of the glucocorticoid receptor, we see that there are several places where we can measure the methylation at CBG sites. And the first study that we did together with Axel Meyer's lab, in particular Karl Radke, has looked at the methylation, and if women are stressed during their pregnancy, you change these methylation patterns. We have replicated that and looked in a larger group of people and also in young children. It's not just during pregnancy, but later on. If the child, either still in the womb or later on, early on, experiences a number of different adversity types, this can be physical abuse, it can be sexual abuse, even already at the age of a baby. It can be emotional neglect. It can be various ways of not providing an ideal or a near ideal environment for the baby. And that changes the methylation. And the methylation later on changes the way of internalizing behavior. Part of it we have measured with the borderline symptom checklist. Borderline means depression, means anger, and also self-harm for producing this vasovagal shutdown. And so we see this correlation. If we look at the two factors, the methylation pattern and the adversive childhood experiences, we find that the greatest number of psychopathological symptoms appears when both is fulfilled, adverse childhood experiences and later on methylation or early on methylation changes. Both come together, people will develop borderline symptoms. Now you could say this is maladaptive. If that's a disorder, borderline patients are highly unstable, they have wide mood springs, they have difficulties in leading a loving, lasting relationship, they're impulsive, and they also are often producing self-harm. But however, you could also say that is too simple to say that this is just a maladaptive response. If you're exposed permanently to a very aversive environment, if there is sexual abuse over years and years, the only way to escape to the situation is to increase the kind of shutdown response, and therefore the self-harm could be actually an adaptive strategy in such a case. Now the question is, do these different methylation patterns affect? Of course we measure it in the saliva, we can measure it in the blood, we cannot measure it in the brain. Do they affect brain responses? And Vanya, I think later on you will talk about this, right? So this is just a teaser for your talk later on, what's going on in the brain. We look at children who have been raised under very severe, harsh conditions of discipline. This is a group of Tanzanian school children where it is common that teachers beat up the children very severely. These people also experience a lot of childhood adversities at home, beginning with poverty, but also physical abuse and sometimes even sexual abuse, and certainly emotional neglect. Physical abuse, emotional abuse, sexual abuse build the score for maltreatment, and that causes internalizing problems, which means problems with the peers, depressive symptoms and emotional problems. And of course, that's not good for the school achievement, and you get smaller working memory. Working memory is the best predictor of school achievement, and your grades in school will go down. So you have internalizing problems, and that's mainly the response of the girls. Boys also show aggressive behavior to a violent environment. And we can see that parental abuse and abuse also through the siblings and witnessing parental abuse, witnessing the violence between the parents, for instance, that creates aggressive behavior and more the externalizing problems. If we look in the methylation patterns, we find changes again in the glucocorticoid regions, but also in the preopiomelanocorticoid promoter region. That is interesting because POMC is a precursor protein that later on is the precursor for ACTH and also beta endorphin. So ACTH is of course part of our major defensive system. So it changes the way we operate our defensive system, and it also includes beta endorphin, which means it's a pain inhibition. And if we look in these boys, in the school boys, we actually, from blood and saliva, both can tell which children have been exposed and which have not been exposed to severe maltreatment during their upbringing. So this POMC, in my view, is a way of preparing children for an active, aggressive situation where they can fight, where they maybe fight back. I think it's what the hunter typically activates, the HPA axis via ACTH, and also the endorphins, not to feel pain when running behind an animal or chasing another human being. This is a hierarchical clustering, and each of these individuals here you can see is assigned to either the non-exposed or exposed. Of course, we are not perfect, but the statistics are quite clear. This is just from a recent study that has appeared in Lancet Public Health last week. If you expose children to interpersonal violence, or if people are submitted to a hospital due to self-harm, so the externalizing or internalizing behaviors, and you compare them to no trauma-related hospital admission, you find a significant difference in the way of how they treat themselves about and the cumulative incidence of self-harm, and also about the criminal acts. This is an interesting study because it includes 1 million Danish people, basically all Danish people at a certain age over certain periods. And you can see that at the age of 30 to 35 years, 25% of those children who have been admitted to a hospital because they have been seriously hurt at home, that can be broken bones, bruises, whatever kinds of injuries, the boys become criminal. They commit criminal acts to an extent that is actually recorded in the police. You can expect that the number is actually higher because not everybody is caught by the police. If you think 50% of all the criminals are caught by the police, well then you would have twice the number. Or in other words, those who commit crimes are those who have experienced serious interpersonal harm during their upbringing. With the women, it's different. Here you see the highest number in the self-harm. Again, you see that 20% of the girls who have been abused show later self-harm behavior. But you can see also that girls become more criminal, but if you look at it more carefully, it's mainly drug abuse. So it's a way also to produce a response that makes them forget or dissociate from their memories. Now you could argue these data are just correlational in nature. Maybe it is because these people don't get the good food, they are not nourished properly during their upbringing, and therefore they become criminal or self-harm. Not a very plausible argument, but it's correlational in nature. So we look at animal studies, and there's studies from the Suomui lab who looked, compared monkeys who have been reared by the mother or those who are reared only amongst peers. And if you compare these two groups later on, you find that those monkeys who have been reared amongst themselves are more aggressive. They actually, when offered alcohol, consume more drugs. So they try to calm themselves down. They are more fearful, and strangely enough, they're also hyper. They show hyper attachment. That means, like actually, if you have ever worked in an orphanage, if you go there, the children approach you when they should actually be fearful and sit on your lap, and the monkey do the same thing. They are more fearful, but try to find somebody to be protected. The Promosal et al. Study, if you want to read that in the Journal of Neuroscience, is interesting. It shows some areas are hypermethylated, others are hypomethylated. So the methylation is high here and low here. And you can see the mother reared and peer reared monkeys show differences here, very clear differences. You can differentiate them very well. And you find differences in the prefrontal cortex. You find difference in the immune system, for instance, in the T cells. And basically what I've done is I've simplified these data. You see that there are some regions that are overexpressed in the mother-reared and underexpressed in the mother-reared compared to the peer-reviewed. And what you see is that basically in the immune system, it's more overexpressed, everything that relates to inflammation, whereas underexpressed is the antiviral response. So they adjust their immune system to potential fight and injuries rather than the pathological conditions these monkeys or humans may encounter in a peaceful environment. Again, back to humans, we see in humans massive changes in the immune system. For instance, the regulatory T cells in people who have experienced a lot of life-threatening conditions are about half. And we see as a consequence then that this is not optimal, and therefore the odds ratio of cardiovascular diseases, of cancer, of autoimmune diseases like diabetes go up as people experience more and more traumatic conditions. Now you could say that's clearly maladaptive, but don't forget it. You can either tune the immune system optimally for an antiviral response or for inflammatory processes. This expression here is adaptive in a violent environment, but maladaptive in a peaceful environment. Now we go to a different situation here, different condition, where my former doctoral student, now postdoc, Fernanda Serpelloni-Henning, she comes from Brazil, and she has investigated subjects, just average citizens in the favelas, in the slums of Rio de Janeiro, in São Gonçalo, and she had looked at grandmothers, at mothers, and at child health. The advantage of going in a situation like that, from the scientific perspective, is, first of all, it doesn't take 80 years before somebody becomes a grandmother, it only takes 50 years. And so you have a much faster sequence of generations. And second, you have a variation in stresses. Somebody threatened to kill me. Mothers would say that to a third of them, or grandmothers. Children, of course, not yet to such an extent. But I've heard guns being shot. Also children say 80%, yes. I've seen dead bodies outside. Also children say 40%. So you have a big variation in how much stresses, how much life-threatening experience these people have experienced. And you could then look at the mental health in the grandma and see there's a correlation with mother cells, and there's even a correlation with the grandchild. And you could say that has to do with parenting. But our data, and also from other studies, are not very conclusive that parenting really explains this transmission across generations. And therefore, the question is, would the epigenetic programming also explain this transmission across generations? So we can look at the stress and think about, does actually across two generations, when this mother is pregnant with a girl child, already the eggs of the grandchild develop while still in the womb of the grandmother. So if the grandmother is stressed, it will change the environment of the child, including its eggs. So it could well be that somehow the stress of the grandmother affects also the germline and the F2 generation. If we look in the animal literature first, yes, we see such effects. And there's the studies from Isabel Manso's lab. She has stressed young mice and the mothers. The mice are stressed by unpredictable maternal separation, so they don't know if the mother's still alive or not. Little mice do not like that very much. And you also stress, restrain stress or force rim, you stress the mother in between. And what we see in the mice, actually, that's I found that very fascinating, that Isabel looked at two different tasks. And one, we would say, is the internalizing behavior. It's this postulate forced swim test, where then in the F2 generation, the female mice give up earlier and spend more time floating. And in the F3 generation, the grandchildren, the male mice, spend more time. That is, if you stress the mother, and stress the child, you can take basically the little mice and make an artificial insemination for the next generation. So the mothers of the next generation have never been aware of that they are inseminated with sperms from a stressed child or not stressed mouse. I'm not, biologists may excuse, I'm not sure what you call a little mouse, a mouse boy. Are there any expressions? But you know what I mean. What do you call it? Okay, good. This is my last slide about mice, and then I don't care about that anymore. It's social defeat. You bring an intruder to that cage, and then that is attacked or not, and you can see how much time does this mouse spend in the corner away from the intruder, or is ready to spend in the interaction zone and to fight. And we again see differences here, whether they have been exposed, whether the father or grandfather has been exposed to stress in the behavior. Okay, now we go back to humans. When we see there's a causal relationship in animals, we can see, do we find the same correlation in humans? We cannot do, of course, the causal studies. We cannot stress a human being, we cannot stress a boy, get and use the semen for artificial insemination in the next generation. But in the mouse you can do that. Here we can look at the correlational data, and we find again that interpersonal violence during pregnancy, there is a sensitive period. Most of that is changed during pregnancy. And what we see, amongst others, is our two candidates, the NR3C1, the glucocorticoid receptor promotion region, and FKBP5. And you see that intimate partner violence changes methylation pattern in both of these cases. And we also see that it's correlated with externalizing problems or with depression problems. And if you look at it more closer, we found, this is, I think, the very interesting finding. With increasing methylation of the promoter region of the glucocorticoid receptors, we find that traumatic stressors cause more aggressive behavior. This is not just now directly the aggressive behavior, it is the interaction. So if you have someone here with a high methylation and you expose that person at the same time or later on, you expose them to traumatic stresses, to life-threatening situations, to fights, to gunshots, to dead bodies, whatever, then you will see that this person becomes more aggressive. I'd say in such a condition, that's more adaptive, right? I mean, you fight back, so to speak. You can call that antisocial, but in such a condition, when a person experiences a lot of violence, it might be better. And we see that it's correlation with IPV of the mother during pregnancy. And it's the other way around for if KBP5. Again, with higher methylation, we see less. Again, it's complicated. The traumatic stresses produce less internalizing behavior, less depression. Okay, so actually, if you're exposed to a situation where there's a lot of traumatic stress, it's better to be on this side because you produce less submissive and less depressive behavior. This again correlates with the pregnancy. So the two really are show opposite correlation. That's minus, that's plus. So the intimate partner violence, children of mothers who have been exposed to partner violence are here and here. So less of these problems. We can look at it, the whole epigenome, and we see regions that are hypermethylated and hypermethylated, very much like in the monkeys. but we were surprised to see when we compared mothers and children that they had somehow opposite methylation patterns. And then we looked at it more systematically over all regions. And Tanjay already explained that you have a high correlation. Explained that you have either low methylation or high methylation. The correlation between mothers and children is, of course, high, not just because they're mothers and children, but in general, these are just across the different sites. But you see there's a variation in the low methylation and the high methylation. You can see, you can summarize this information, and you find areas in the hetero or euchromatin region that are either hyper or hypomethylated, and you find different response in the children than in the mothers. These are the mothers in Sao Gonzalo. and you find also a different responding in a German sample and in an American study where these subjects may have experienced violent environments already during their pregnancy or later on, but live in a peaceful environment. And that brings us to the conclusion that depending on the situation later on, intimate partner violence sets off a process that can, depending on the particular cultural conditions and environmental situations that you experience during childhood, changes these patterns. We have tried to factorize it, and we see there's basically an epigenetic factor and a psychosocial factor. And again, we see that mothers and children behave differently. So that makes the situation a bit complicated because we do not simply have one response of methylation patterns, even in this HPA axis and other regions, but we get a dynamic interaction with the environment. Okay, grandmother, this is a volcano plot, and you can see we have also a number of sites that show effects or relationship to the community and domestic violence of the grandmother. So the grandmother already tells something to the eggs of where later on the grandchild develops. Many thanks to the reviewers, by the way. Now, okay, we see we have a difference in the methylation. We also saw that the juvenile subculture can somehow modify the methylation patterns. Now then the question, of course, for us as psychologists is, can we manipulate it by corresponding treatment and therapy? And so far we do not really know that. I have only two more minutes to go, because it will be your task, Daniela, to finally find out whether this is true, what some preliminary data suggest. This is one study from the Yehuda Lab in New York that with treatment responders show a different methylation pattern than those who do not get a psychotherapeutic treatment. And this is a just study that appeared also this month. With trauma-focused treatment, you change the symptom score, that's the CAPS, clinician admitted PTSD scale. So this is an improvement, and those who improve a lot also change their FKBP5 expression, and they also change the hippocampal volume, and the two are correlated. I'm not sure whether these data can be really trusted. They need to be extended and replicated, but they are very promising, saying that psychotherapy may alter and reverse some of the maladaptive consequences in a certain condition. Maybe adaptive in one, but maladaptive in other conditions. Okay, my last slide is why it is so complicated. That's also what Tunche already mentioned in this first slide from 1957. small changes somehow, once you go on a different path, you have not one single impact, but you change the self-regulatory system, and it will go in a different direction, different paths, and life-threatening experiences are a possibility to manipulate all the regulatory system, brain circuits, chromatin maintenance, but immunity and so forth. Yeah. So make sure your chromatin is properly maintained in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas. Also for being in time, we have now some minutes for questions. I already saw the answer.
Thank you very much for this talk. It was very, very interesting, especially for me as a biologist to get more insights, and that's what the conference is for. You were nicely showing the differences between males and females, so women and men. And later on, you were showing differences between the mother and the children that were either exposed to stress or not. First question would be, does children mean then boys and girls? And second,
children?
Sorry, first question would be, would then in this case children mean boys and girls? And second question is, how can you then control for this difference in males and females looking at this?
In the Brazil study, we had grandmothers, of course, all female, mothers, all female, and then the children were boys and girls. So, you see differences. read Axel's book, and then it says their boys and girls are different, and we see that in all the data. I did not present that in detail. It's complicated. We have not understood a number of aspects in that relation. We have also not understood, at least I have not understood, the mouse data. It seems to be that, you know, from the stressed fathers, the daughters seem to be more affected, and then the grandchildren, the boys, seem to be more affected, and I don't know why that's the case. But the effect is maybe there in both sexes, but it seems to be stronger in this alternating fashion. I don't know really why. I can explain you why a woman tend to have more easily a dissociative shutdown, why women fall more easily unconscious when they are attacked. I think that's a biological response, that men have a greater survival rate if they fight back, and women probably a greater survival rate if they do not fight back, because usually the attacker can be stronger if it's at least the traditional way of fighting.
Yes. Thank you very much. So, I have a question comparing Daphne and human from the talk. So, to the Daphne, what you showed, I know that that's true. When they see the pheromones of fish, then have these initial defenses, the heritage over multiple generations, it's fine. But we also have some populations which don't react because they're not used to fish. They're lost this or never evolved. So, there are some which don't take the cue. Fish pheromone to induce the defense. I don't know, it's not so easy to work with human, of course, like Daphnia, but would you see something different that you have a cue specificity? Because the specificity of the cue, I don't imagine how being beaten up is not a stress, but the only thing I could come up with is cannibals. When they see that body, it's not a stress to them. So it's a bit absurd, but can you see that really the system is not a general response, that it's adapted to specific cues, that the information content of the experience matters between population of humans?
I'm not sure whether I understood your question. Can you rephrase?
So you have different cues which cause stress.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's say you by cues you mean, for instance, the smell of the predator or the presence of the predator. Okay, that stresses the Daphnia mother, right? Okay, so you have a stress for the Daphnia mother. Okay. So,
but for some others it's not a stress because they never saw fish their whole life. The information of the fish smell is not their stress. You know what I mean? So they smell it, but they are ignorant.
How do you know? Well, I don't know. I don't know. I've never talked to Daphnia, but but this is the biologist should explain that. I mean, my interpretation would be I know that fish have an HPA axis, but I don't think Daphnia have something similar. I don't know how they respond to the situation. So, but I think, I mean, can you say they are stressed or not? I don't know. They are threatened. There we can say.
Some would be eaten, but they don't relate to cues, so they don't induce the helmets and all these defenses, they don't. Just some populations which are inhabited where
yeah.
they're not fish.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, so they don't have the information content of the cue as a stress. And I was wondering if there's something in humans where you can say the same, that you can compare a population. The only thing I came up with is cannibals, but I don't work in humans.
Yeah.
The dead body is not a stress. But cannibals seeing a dead body
adaptation is a matter for the evolutionary biologists. Okay. I need to be careful. But Axel just was, and then Robert.
I think my IRB is going to approve that experiment.
But there's no example, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent.
If you talk about adaptation, you mean this should mean higher fitness, right? So the boys in the favelas that respond less stressed to more violence. Could you follow up and see if they have more children than the guys that are more stressed?
Adaptation implies differences in fitness.
Yeah.
And you show that in the favelas, the boys, although there are many boys that are exposed to stress, will respond less aggression compared to others. So could you follow them and see if they have more children?
Yeah, sure. That would be possible. Actually, we still have the, but already now, already now, in terms of psychopathology, we could say it is probably, if, that's my message, if these boys are exposed to a violent environment, they show less psychopathology in the sense they are less dysfunctional, they are more functional. Of course, the question is, what exactly, how do you measure functionality? And you would say, yeah, I measured like a biologist as a number of offspring, okay? That's not possible. But we can see how well are they doing in terms of their functioning, in terms of their working memory, in terms of their school performance, or later on, in terms of their occupational. How long they live. So we thought we look at the methylation clock, and they age slower, which is again different from the situation here, where those who have been exposed to stress, if you measure in the Germans or also in the refugees who have come to Germany, we see that their indicators for aging, be it methylation clock or other indicators, that they age faster. Is that a biological fitness if you age slower? I'm not sure.
Well, as a male, if you live longer, you have presumably more chances of fathers. Okay. Well, I guess. So that would be some sort of
Okay. Good.